is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thank you for joining us today for another edition of Midrats. For those that are with us live, if you are so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find a link to the chat room. Unfortunately, we found out before the show that neither the host nor the co-host could access the chat room. So there will be general chaos, though not really, because we actually have our guest that has managed to get into the chat room. So we're going to give him the cattle prod, the pliers, and the blowtorch to make sure that everybody behaves themselves in the chat room. But if you're so inclined, you can go there, and he has some observations you would like to share during the course of the show. That's a great place to go. Usually I'd say if you have some questions, you can put them there, and we'll roll them in. But if we're not going to see it, we can't. But maybe, Chris, if somebody rolls him a good question, he'll grab it and bring it into the conversation. And as always, if you need to take off before the show is done, you'll catch up on what you missed. Or if you haven't been with us for a while and you want to catch up on your previous shows, you can always subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes, Spreaker, or any of the other aggregators that you use to get your podcast. And now let's roll right into today's topic. And I'm going to kind of round this out in opening questions, but when you look at the concept of quickly turning merchant ships or non-traditional objects into warships, things useful at war, that whole idea is as old as mankind. It's nothing new, whether you call them auxiliary cruisers, privateers, or a war canoe. What you use in peace can oftentimes be repurposed for war, or even things that were used for war, you can find more uses for them. And a lot of the options that we need to look at today has to do with a regular topic here on Midrats that we like to brag that we are early adopters on, but it's glad that most of the smart eyes are looking to the far end of the Pacific, and especially with some of the more hard-nosed war games we've seen as of recently, there has been a lot of concern about our ability to even if we had the planning assumption that we can get unopposed across the Pacific, do we have enough game to bring to the fight once we get there? Some of the things that have come up recently involve ways that we can do that from the sea. And we are going to look at that today with a returning guest, Chris Lawley. He's the CEO of Harvest Returns, a platform for investing in agriculture, who, when he's not busy working that 100-hour week, he is a captain of the U.S. Naval Reserve and is the Naval Reserve Chief of Staff for Commander Naval Surface Forces. And he is here today speaking strictly on his own behalf, but not representing any of the organizations that he may or may not be associated with. Chris, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks, Sal. Glad to be here.
And we appreciate you coming on board to talk about a topic that I know our listeners here, they've already read a few articles, they've probably engaged in conversations about a topic that, though it's always been there, it really has broken above the background noise this summer. And one of the few things that's broken above the background noise this summer, it has nothing to do with COVID, but it has to do with various ideas about what we can do to get additional firepower available to our forces, really on a global scale, but in a blunt sense, to go to the Western Pacific. And some of the things that people are starting to talk about are missile barges, It's one term, converting merchant ships or existing platforms into what we used to call the previous decade or two arsenal ships. Different ways of doing that. And not just BLS, but other ways of converting merchant ships or merchant platforms into something that we can bring to the fight in order to increase our fleet numbers to, I'm not a huge fan of the phrase distributed lethality, but I am a big fan of distributed risk. And they also are rolling into being able to do these things, ways to do it without breaking the manpower bank through everything from utilizing reserves to optimal manning or even unmanned systems. What are some of the other items you think have contributed to this topic becoming more and more a regular conversation point, both inside and outside the Naval's lifeline?
So thanks, Sal. Just to lay the foundation here, as most of them, I'm sure your listeners know, that the Mark 41 BLS is sort of our foundation of firepower in a fleet, whether we're talking about doing ballistic missile defense, anti-surface warfare, anti-submarine warfare, or strike, or air defense. These Mark 41s and the missiles they carry are vital. The problem is when you look at what the late, great Captain Hughes talks about in Fleet Tactics, and as an aside, if you're a naval officer and you haven't read Fleet Tactics, shame on you. But he talks about missile exchange salvos, and what this all comes down to is we simply don't have enough tubes, and we don't have enough hulls to carry the tubes. So that's part of what I think is driving this discussion is that as we look at different fleet options, and there's been a number of proposals thrown out and being discussed actively right now. A few of those are ones put forth by the Navy, but a more recent interesting one, once I've just kind of finished going through this weekend, is the Hudson Institute's, it's called American Sea Power at Crossroads, a plan to restore the U.S. Navy's maritime advantage. It's a study by Brian Clark, Tim Walton, and Seth Cropsey, and these guys are really smart on this subject, and so I've kind of been digesting this plan and some of the elements of it, and one of the goals of this is to add complexity to our fleet. And I think, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And when you look at ways to get number of missile tubes out there, part of our equation should be not just let's build more DDGs or you know, CGXs or whatever large surface combatant. Part of the way to get more complexity is to look at other platforms, maybe some non-traditional hull types that could bring more of those missile tubes to bear. And some of the questions that we should ask ourselves are, one, how can we do this affordably? Two, how can we do this in a manner, you know, there's a balance between number of tubes and hulls and what's the right ratio. And then there's a mix. There's a lot of creative ways to do this, and I'm not advocating any one way. What I am advocating is that the surface Navy probably needs to increase in size, and there's different ways to do that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the dangers of distributed lethality. As I understand it, the concept is we're going to, and there was a pretty nice article in Proceedings by Captain Harris and a number of other folks, which talked about taking a tanker or something and dropping in a hull, a merchant hull, dropping in some BLS tubes, and they thought that we needed something like 20 or 30 of these ships, maybe 15. But my question has been, why, if we're going to build large or convert large ships, aren't those just additional large, high-value targets, also fairly easily targetable by whatever opponent we would face? And is there, in your mind, an optimum size of a ship that would be capable of adding enough tubes to the fleet if we had enough of those ships, and or if we had unmanned platforms that could accompany those ships?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the key question, I think, Eagle One, is that You've got some pictures in the page of Arsenal ship concepts and unmanned towed barges. Another one looks like a converted tanker. Those are interesting ideas. I'm not sure putting all our eggs in, you know, all our BLS eggs in one basket is a good idea unless it's in something like that's pretty damn secure, like an SSGN or the Virginia subs with the BPM modules, where they can carry a larger number of missiles than a regular submarine. Where that's pretty, those guys are going to be pretty secure. But let's say a converted oil tanker. You know, we have these in our fleet already, the Alaska class oil tankers that are built at NASSCO in San Diego, and they're the basis of the ESB expeditionary support base and the Mopper class, I guess, expeditionary support dock. I think I got those two acronyms right. Those hulls. And so, yeah, I think in a pinch, we could probably take some of those type of ships or other BLCCs and drop a bunch of VLS Mark 41 modules in there and put a pretty small crew on there or have it managed offboard. And that would get us more cells, but I'm not sure that's what we need. The Hudson Institute, going back to that study, they recommend that we build a larger number of Corvettes that have 24 to 32 cell VLSs in them. And I think something along those lines, more smaller ships might be the answer. As far as arming merchants, that's kind of what the original article I wrote about 5 years ago, and that's what Lee is talking about in the chat room. It's an interesting idea. I think I guess for one, I'm not necessarily in favor. There's concepts and discussion about the TAKE class going around putting some surface to surface missiles on them. I don't think that's bad. Maybe from an offensive standpoint, but we have a combat logistics force for a reason, is to provide combat logistics. And so if the missiles are adding to that mission by keeping the ships a little safer, then that's a good idea. If they're not, if they're taken away from that mission, then maybe that's something we shouldn't do. I personally think we just need more smaller, cheaper hulls, because that's the only way we're going to get there from here. But like I said, there's different ways to get there.
One thing that I've worry about a lot in the next decade. And you mentioned it right there, part of your comment of smaller and affordable is affordable, and that's budgetary pressure. And I think you've already seen it as well. Many times when you bring this up, people will say, well, we need more SSGNs. Well, okay. Those are pretty darn expensive, and we only are going to produce one or two of those a year, and I'm interested in your new design, though the Virginia payload module gives you a few. Or your air power advocate, though, well, we just need to invest more in BB-21. I mean, not BB. Sorry, David Lauder, I didn't want to get you excited. The B-21, the new bomber that's yet to make a shadow on the ramp. Or they'll talk like a little Corvette. Now, those first two items, huge amount of money, and they're not going to be here before 2030. A small Corvette, depending upon what design and how much you want to fast track it, maybe we would see something by 2030. If we picked an existing design or a modification of one and it had enough political oomph to it. But if you're somebody that says, I need to have some type of solution that gives me the ability to surge, you know, use whatever scary round number you want to, number of additional warheads in Westpac by 2030, what are some of the realistic platforms people could look at that if somebody gave you a bucket of money and some top cover that we could look at getting displacing water and the ability to head west by 2030, you think?
Yeah, I mean, if there's a time crunch, and I don't know, depends on who you talk to, there is or there isn't. There's plenty of European, very nice Corvette designs that we could change out the French-made VLS and put in our VLS, or we can look at, you know, if we're talking surface-to-surface, we've got the Naval Strike Missile is starting to hit the fleet in some numbers, a lot of it depends on what mission we're lacking the missiles, and I don't want to, you know, get into the types of you know, where we're short on what size missiles, because honestly, I don't know, and two, it wouldn't be appropriate. But let's just take anti-submarine or anti-surface warfare, surface warfare. There's a lot of different platforms that could provide those, and whether it's a vertical launch system, whether it's using something like an SM-6 in a surface mode, that's one way to do it. There's a lot of talk these days and a lot of forward movement on unmanned surface vessels and potentially arming a large unmanned surface vessel, the LUSV, and we've got a lot of experimentation going on right now with that program, and we'll see some more in the next couple of years in fleet experiments, which is a good thing. The question is, you know, how, one, is the technology there? In some respects it is, in some respects it isn't. We've got 2 decades plus of experience dropping ordnance remotely from UAVs, and from that perspective, there's no reason we couldn't be doing it from remotely operated surface ships. But there's many concerns on that as far as, you know, how do you see to these things? How do you work in a denied environment? Is the autonomy there? You know, what is the manning concept? Is it optionally manned? So are we talking about a Corvette where you're kind of doing day-to-day steaming? You've got these ships are in an OFRP type cycle where you've got, you know, they're out doing exercises, and then when you need them to put ordnance in an area that could be a somewhat denied environment, you don't want to put the crew at risk. You ship the crew off, and you flip on the remote control switch and send them forward. And if some of them get sunk, that's okay. They get sunk. There's no loss of lives there. So these are some of the trade-offs people are having conversations on in the Navy.
Well, I have this vision, and as Sal has accused me of getting it from the Honor Harrington books, but I have this vision of seeing a squadron of ships, maybe led by corvettes, maybe led by a DDG, but also accompanied by what the air people are calling, the wingmen, the unmanned wingmen concept, and letting them go out to various areas and do their thing. And a lot of the concerns would be, how do you control the missiles on those unmanned platforms? We're going to use those. And, my concern was, well, if you've got a shooter, a sensor concept where the information is being relayed to the squadron leader, if you will, that that ship can then signal the other unmanned units to do whatever they're going to do. And I'm looking at that and I go, well, there's, you know, as you just said, there's some weaknesses there, and especially in the comms aspect of it. How much of a concern is that? Do you think that we don't have the, you know, we're looking at concepts that may just be a bridge too far, or is this something that if we really put our minds to it, we could fix?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a proponent for, we need more of everything in the Navy. We need more ships. We need more manpower, because we don't have the manpower to operate the ships we have now. And that's a huge one. We can't have this conversation of expanding a fleet without talking about expanding manpower, because frankly, we're not where we need to be right now. But we also need more robust comms and more, to use the Hudson's term, complex comms. Man, we're relying on some really high-end, super expensive satellites in the Navy communications, and there's reasons for that and good reasons. But look at what's going on in the civilian world. Look at what Elon Musk's Starlink company is doing. And if you're not paying attention to that, you should be, because it's amazing where we're going to have a constellation of I think he's talking 30,000 satellites in orbit that are going to reach all around the world. Try to deny that. Why aren't we putting a Starlink terminal on every single surface warship as a secondary, tertiary form of communications? And there's jamming and things like that. So the C2 structure is something that we certainly need to look at. And, you know, when it comes right down to it, I think the Navy could excel at that if we'd let ourselves, because we have this history of command by negation, and more recently, you know, the Army picked up the doctrinal term and called it mission command, but it's really just command by negation, where decisions are made at lower level commands. We can do this. We just have to let ourselves try and experiment with it. So that's, I mean, that's a long answer to your pretty succinct question, Eagle One.
Yeah, you use one of my favorite words there, the E word, the experimentation, and that's something that we've had a great history with, to the point that sometimes people said it was inefficient because we would take commissioned platforms, and when they're in an extended availability period, we would put new and different weapons on them. And that's not standard. It's like, I know that's not standard, but we're going to play around with it, give it to the sailors for a few deployments, and let them tell us what they want. So I think that is, as opposed to where we like the PowerPoint, we're going to accept the PowerPoint, we're going to sign billions of dollars, cross our fingers and hope, and then have it fall on our face. I think, you know, run four or five experiments and with the knowledge that two of them will work, and we can build from there. And when you look at some of the experiments, you touched on one of them. Areas that we need to look at if we want to make this system grow and to give us more downrange. Communications, both voice and data, various ways of maintaining systems that are optimally manned or unmanned, are finding a way for automation to work in case your comm links aren't going. You know, there's tons of other areas that we can experiment in. But in those three areas, communication, maintenance, and automation, independent automation, AI, whatever term you want to use, what do you think those three areas are? Which one of those is the most mature, and which of those three do you think will be the last chip to fall into place that would give us more options?
Yeah, I'm by no means an unmanned system expert. There are some folks out there who are. You should get them on your show. But the automation piece, that's a software problem, and I'm not sure we put a lot of thought into that. I think we have it down on the air side pretty well. It's actually a simpler problem on the air side, because you can, you know, if you lose comms with a UAV, most of them have various return to base sorts of algorithms in place. It's a little bit, you know, if you lose comms with a surface ship, where do you go and what does it do next? And does it just go DIW? That's probably not such a good thing if there's missiles flying. Communications, I really think we could fix that when everybody freaks out about jamming and, you know, comms denial and losing satellites and things like that. But I mean, jamming is temporal. It's not all places at all times. And so it's a big ocean. You just need to have distributed forces so that you're not overly impacted that. And then, you know, you said maintenance. Yeah, maintenance, the long pole in the tent of these USVs is getting engines, diesel engines that just run without any sort of human intervention. And I'm not sure we'll ever get there. So maybe we should be looking at alternative propulsion systems. And number one, number two, maybe they don't need to run for 30 days at a time. Maybe they only need to run for 48 hours at a time, go out, shoot their load and come back, or, you know, get blown up. If we're only going to use them once, we have, you know, if we need get to the point where we're going to need to use these, we're probably going to need to use them pretty badly, and losing a few dozen is probably not such a bad thing when it comes right down to it, if they're able to get out and deploy their payloads.
Yeah, one of the things you in that piece you wrote about distributed lethality, non-traditional fleets, and the law of war was the use of the reserve forces to act, I guess, as the combatant controllers for ships like auxiliaries if we were to arm them. And I thought it was kind of ironic because the USNS concept for the auxiliaries happened while I was on active duty. And before that, we had USS ammunition ships and oilers and other auxiliaries, which were weapon. I mean, we carried, we weren't heavily armed, but in those days we had 3-inch 50s on our ships, and there's no reason we couldn't have had other stuff. And I think we do equip some of our ships, USNS ships, with teams that go on board to offer security, depending on where they're transiting. Any event, talk a little bit about the concept of using reserves to act as the combat component of an auxiliary type force.
Sure. So we're actually doing this right now on the EPF. So I've got friends who have been on or currently embarked in Naval Reservists who are MILDET OICs out on the Expeditionary Fast Transports in the Mediterranean, and there's some other vessels we've got reservist OICs and ops officers on. So we're doing that the C2 piece of it. In these cases, these people are acting more like IAs rather than sort of a strategic break glass in case of war reserve. But I think it makes a lot of sense. If you have these vessels that we're going to maybe keep unmanned vessels, we're going to keep forward pre-positioned, maybe not use a lot except for once or twice a year to make sure they still run and do some testing and experimentation or fleet exercises with them to make sure we're interoperable with them. But they're sort of forward deployed, sitting someplace low key, waiting to be activated when we really need them, with their missile tubes full. If we want to kind of have that model, then that meshes perfectly what the Navy Reserve does, where you've got a group of reservist units that and I'm actually, full disclosure, I'm part of a project to put together some reserves units that are supporting Surface Development Squadron Run 1, who's working on our USV fleet. So we're working on this. I'd like to see it happen. And I'll put in a plug for the Navy Reserve is we are also lacking in manpower. I mean, people might argue with me on that, but there's some graphs circulating through the Pentagon that show Air National Guard, Army National Guard, Army Reserve, Air Force Reserve, Marine Corps Reserve, and they show sort of the in strength from year 2000 to today. And the Navy Reserve has taken it in the pants the biggest. We've had lost about 33% of our in strength since year 2001, give or take. And I think we need more reservists. We need more reservists supporting the fleet. And if you it's something that I'm very passionate about because I've done it for a long time, and I know so many good people doing it. But I think something like this mission would be excellent for the reserve force.
I think it would. It would also be going back to my little bugbear that I mentioned earlier in the show. I think also it can be quite cost effective because I think some of the options that people are looking at to bring additional units to the front if needed may not necessarily be things, whether they're the my co-host Honor Harrington class missile barges or some type of converted merchantmen or your small corvettes. There's no requirement why these would have to be full up round active duty all the time units. Back when I was a kid, the U.S. Naval Reserve, both in the air and the surface force, actually had units. Unfortunately, they were a little worn out units left over. But is that an option we could look at to have additional units ready that we should go up if the balloon goes up? That would allow us in wartime to have more capability following activation than we would in peace, or is that in some ways a false economy?
Yeah, this is another thing that's kind of in my portfolio and I've looked at is should we bring back reserve ships? And a lot of people there's a piece of, there's a certain part of the reserve or X reserve, whatever, that wants it. I just don't think it's a viable concept. When you do the math, you're going to need, by the time you look at the ratio of selected reservists to full-time support reservists or full-time crew, it just doesn't make any sense. Now, we do have, like I said, we have reservists out augmenting our military sea lift command fleet. We have reservists augmenting USS fleet, kind of filling some gaps where their skills are needed and going out on deployment for 6 or 9 months or whatever. And I think that's a good use of us. And then we also have reservist, let's take your favorite platform, Sal, the Littoral Combat Ship. We have quite a few reservists that are dedicated to support that ship class, doing things like maintenance and some watchstanding and some other things and forward deployed maintenance. And so there's plenty of roles for reservists. This unmanned role, I think, would be a good one. You're going to need somebody to drive these ships in case of war, and those ship drivers don't necessarily have, they obviously need to know the rules of the road and be probably OOD qualified or, some sort of, so they don't run into one another, and have the requisite weapons calls. But just imagine sitting in a trailer or a bunker somewhere, CONUS or somewhere forward deployed, you fly out a bunch of reservists and some reservists go and they pull off the tarps on the ships and, check the oil and fuel them up and get them underway. And the other reservists jump in these sort of portable CICs type of things and start fighting the ships. I think that's a pretty viable option because it's something that is more conducive to training for and the day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month reserve sort of battle rhythm.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned portable CICs because as an old inshore undersea warfare guy, it's exactly what we had, the CIC in a box that sat on the beach, but there was no reason that I could figure that if we needed to and we wanted to, we could have taken that. And I mean, we had sonar, we had surface search radar. There's no reason we couldn't have taken that box, plugged it into the systems on a merchant ship or whatever, and operated just as a CIC, just as you say. It could have done with a few minor changes, could have done pretty much what a CIC does on any other ship, although less sophisticated than that of a upper class DDG, but nonetheless, it could have been done. And I, the second point to that is we had very good sonar techs, very good ETs, and other people who they left active duty, but they could have maintained their skills quite well and did for us in the reserves. And as you point out in your article, there's no reason they can't use simulators to maintain their quals and set pretty high standards. So I'm in favor of that concept, in case you're wondering. But let's talk a little bit about the one of the things we kind of addressed. I think the last time you were in the chat room, kind of kibitzing as we went along on our free for all, was how do we get if the balloon goes up and you got one of these ships out at sea and you want to get the crew off because the ship they're on has the capability of going into a unmanned mode. How do we protect that crew? And one of the suggestions I think that was made in that last chat was we have some kind of ship or small vessel that they can just drop into and drive away. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think we were just spitballing, but one of the ideas that I brought it up, or you brought it up, or somebody brought it up, was hey, this might be a littoral combat ship mission is to evacuate or exfiltrate the crews from these optionally manned corvettes. And then at the same time, they jump right into Mission Bay of the LCS, and they start C2ing those ships from some sort of remote, container, CIC in a box or whatever. And Mark, I too was an old school Naval Coastal Warfare guy, and I've got, that's a great community, and I did a deployment to Iraq with those guys and saw a lot of interesting things and, did the boat unit thing. I think that's a community that we honestly should look at bringing back, because if you look at the capabilities we had back then, they were pretty rudimentary. We had sonar buoys and really crappy thermal imagers that were tied to a Humvee. But if you look at the night and day computing power and electronics and sensors and the advancements we've had, we could make a pretty potent offensive littoral targeting both on the surface and anti-ASW side, if we would spend some money and some energy on that community. And I'd love to see that happen. We shifted away from that into the force protection, boat heavy units when I was part of that community, and rightfully so, because that's where the demand signal was post-coal. And now it might be time to look at some other ideas to rejuvenate that community with some land-based, expeditionary-based targeting capability.
When my co-host was mentioning when auxiliaries used to be armed, the one thing that it came to mind is when war comes, more often than not, the arguing in the debate club ends, and you get underway and you do what you have to do with what you have. And I was reminded of the story of the Atlantic Conveyor during the Falkland Islands War, where there were arguments even while she was underway and loaded up about the legality of auxiliaries, whether they could be armed with either passive or active defense systems. And they didn't wait for the argument to get figured out. They grabbed their Chinooks and their Harriers and their Westlands, and they took off. And they got hit by the two Exocets, because when you got a big old ship like that, the Seeker Head, it looks like any other big ship that you want to hit. They wind up losing 12 sailors on board the Atlantic Conveyor. And here we are decades later. And that you still hear that argument going on. Where is that status in the American conversation when it comes to auxiliaries or merchantmen that we may need to requisition to have them move forward, to give them some type of defense capability? Have we worked out the legal side of the house, or is that still a debate club?
Sal, I'm glad you brought up the Atlantic Conveyor, because that was on my talking points to bring up if nobody else did. So yeah, the key part of that is there was a push for some self-defense weapons to be put on board that ship, and the JAGS overruled it. And you're exactly right. We do things that are expedient in times of war, and I've seen this, but I've also seen us make some really dumb mistakes, out and about in my Navy travels, where letting lawyers and letting politicians, for lack of a better word, make decisions that operators should be making has gotten people wounded or killed. Whole other story, but saw it in East Africa with some B-22s back during Operation Oaken Sonnet. So all that said, I don't think it's resolved. And I think we need to operators run the Navy. God love our JAGs. We need them for a lot of reasons, especially our operational law JAGs. But they make recommendations, and then the operational commanders make decisions. And that's the way the world should work, and most of the time does work. But you can look back. I'm not an operational law guy, but you can look back at whether it's Ewan Close or more recently, or the Treaty of, was it San Remo or whatever? It's like a 70s document that lawyers will some of our JAGs, especially military SEAL guys, will point back to that and say, oh, we can't put armaments on ships. Like, I say bullshit to that, frankly, because the history of naval warfare is a history of private companies and contractors and merchant sailors engaging in warfare right alongside their regular Navy counterparts. So when there's a will, there's a way, and I hope that our operational decision makers keep that in mind whenever comes time to tell their JAG, thanks, noted, but this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting if you go back to the history of the merchant ships going to and from the East Indies. Those guys were all armed. It's incredible we've somehow gotten ourselves a position where arming a ship that's in, with piracy, we're allowing the merchant ships at sea to take on private security teams who get to act in the best interests of the ship and provide self defense, which is part of the function of arming a merchant ship. I fail to understand why this is, personally, as a lawyer who doesn't specialize in San Remo or UNCLOS necessarily, I don't understand why this is such a big deal, but the solution is that if you want to, worst case is you just make everything USS, and as you pointed out, I think in your article with the Ponce, they have a mixed crew, and you can still do operational kind of things with that. But as you say, sometimes people get a little too cautious and forget that the purpose of the military is to blow up things and break things and stuff. So, and I want to go back to something we talked about earlier. We did take our MU van, and put it on a barge to work with the Coast Guards. This was down in Corpus Christi. We actually loaded it on a barge, and we were going to use it to put in the intercoastal waterway to look for some drug smugglers. We weren't going to be the apprehending officers, of course, because we were just providing information under posse comitatus. But just to point out that such thing is possible for these box-type units. I know we've had other kinds of vans that went on ships that communications vans and all sorts of things. So that concept, I agree with you, needs to come back. And I think that's a really important thing to be discussing about how to, especially when you're talking about how to make these converted merchant ships, if we're going to go that way, work.
Yeah, it's something I'd like to see happen. And MIUW 108, very familiar with that unit back in the day.
Yeah, that was my unit. I was CO of that for 3 years.
Let's touch back a bit for talking about VLS, and you know, we make an assumption here about being able to attack land targets from the sea, to use a marketing term. But one of my Irish readers sent me a little note. John Harper, he's right. I mean, our allies, we have the ability, and we want more of an ability, to engage targets ashore. The Russians have had an extended live fire exercise in Syria with their cruise missiles coming off in some of their very nice Corvette-sized ships and their submarines as well. But when we look at the ships that our allies have coming on board, the new French frigates, and these are light frigates, I guess, is in the American terms, the French FTI, the German 180 class, the Netherlands, they're replacing their M-class frigates, and the new Italian light frigate. These are only planning to have 16 VLS cells by themselves, and they're all, from what I've read, for anti-air. No one else really seems to be investing in to be able to send ordnance across the beach, so to speak. Are they seeing something we're not, or is this another case of our allies going, yeah, that's a great requirement, but we're allies with the U.S. and they'll take care of that for us? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you may be right on the allies, but I wouldn't say nobody, because the Russians have a pretty amazing missile system, at least from all appearances. I don't know much about it. The Caliber missile system, which can engage, I think they were shooting, weren't they shooting into Syria from the Caspian early on? So that's a capability.
Yeah, Caspian, the Eastern Med. I think the Indians have actually done some exercises with using the Bravos missile in a land attack mode too. So the Indians, they're playing in the club too.
Yeah, and you know, the Mark 41 VLS is an amazing system, and it served us well for what, 3 decades, I guess. It just in the spirit of that complexity, it might be good to look at some other, you know, types of systems. You know, there's the Russians, going back to the Russians, they have the Club K, which is basically a cargo container that pops up and shoots missiles. There's no reason we couldn't develop a similar sort of capability. I believe maybe Raytheon is working on something like that. There's all different ways to get missile tubes out there. Some interesting things, we haven't talked about the Marine Corps at all, but they're doing some interesting things where they have these joint-like tactical vehicles, which is kind of their mainstay that's going to be replacing the Humvee and some other chassis, where it's a sort of unmanned chassis that is going to be able to launch the naval strike missile. So it's a pretty lightweight, easily transportable, shoot and scoot sort of missile system, which I think will serve the Marines well and hopefully the Navy if they're supporting us.
That's the other side of the coin that we also don't talk about is very much is that China talks about its island chains. We've got the same thing. I mean, if you depends on how far out you want to go, but we, in addition to having the fleet, we have places we could restart using as bases if we had the vision to do so. Midway and Wake Island and some other places, and I know Palau is offering to let us set up a base there, plus our allies and other Australia and Singapore and places like that and Japan. But, that is another factor to consider, and that's what the Marines are looking at, I guess, is being that forced to take that some of those close-in but land-based actions against an opposing fleet or opposing land forces.
Yeah, and a key part of that, taking that back to the surface side, a key part of that force structure is the Marine Corps. Well, they have a number of contacts, but the expeditionary base operations in order to support that sort of a smaller, more distributed amphib fleet, and beginning with what they're calling the light amphibious warship, which I hate when we make up new ship classes, but it's basically an LST because it's a beachable, I forget how many tons, but holds basically a company of Marines or so. And their vehicles, and you could move around to all these archipelagos in the Western Pacific, the first and second island chains, and really complicate some things as far as the targeting problem go.
Luckily, we were muted here because it was so nice to see somebody else say, I think, why don't we just call it an LST? I don't know why people feel the need to create new acronyms. I don't think it buys them anything from scorn, but maybe it's an inside the beltway. I have no idea, but if they just say it's an LST, I think we could invest more time talking about the requirement as opposed to having people ask questions. Why is it called this? Define light. Why? Yeah. But we don't live in my world, and that might be a good thing, but you're talking about the Marines, what they could do ashore, and I know even the Army has flirted with make coastal artillery great again or something like that. But it goes down back to, I think, that realization that I opened my question with earlier on the show. And more people realize that the China of 2020 is not the China of 2005, which is where a lot of people broke lock on it. And question I wanted to ask you here is, I think a lot of assumptions were made about bringing ordnance over west that made assumptions about what we were going to load into our Mark 41, because VLS tubes, it's valuable real estate, but it's kind of like a revolver. You load it, and you put it in your pocket, and what you load it with, if you load your revolver full of nothing but snake shot, and all of a sudden you have a bear in front of you, you're in a little bit of trouble there. So there's a lot of the things that we've talked about here, bringing additional VLS tubes to the front, is simply acknowledgement of the fact that in Aegis destroyers, 91 VLS tubes probably need to be focused on things other than land attacks if we're going to have to fight our way from Midway Island west.
Well, yeah, I mean, without getting into the makeup of an average DDG's deployment loadout, we all know that ballistic missile defense has become an important mission for our Aegis ships that are so thus configured to have the right baselines and missiles and all those sorts of things. And, frankly, burning holes in a mod lock for weeks and months on end is not a good use of naval resources from my perspective. I mean, I guess it made sense when we did it, but now that we're talking about taking up, like you said, VLS real estate with that, we probably need to look at moving some of that ashore. And, you know, if we're defending, we're talking about defending land with ballistic missiles for the most part. So let's put the defenders on land. And that's not a discussion I want to go too much into, but the real estate is important. And do we need to shift more of that to an offensive surface load or vertical launch ASRox or some follow on? I think the Hudson Institute mentions a follow on longer range VLA, which I think is an amazing idea. But there's more than one way to deploy ordnance in a maritime environment, and I don't want to exclude our naval air and our Air Force brethren, because they have a role in that as well.
Yeah, the fascinating thing about this whole conversation is that we are always, as it's noted in the chat room right now, the balance of the tyranny of distance in the Pacific, which is what we're really talking about, plus the amount of money involved to get a fleet, including its supply train that's needed to support that fleet, and to disperse the fleet, which I think you also pointed out that one of the issues in distributive lethality is that also the issues of rearming and supporting the fleet are also complicated. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are your thoughts on how, is this really just a money issue, money and people issue, or is also strategic thinking needs to be applied more thoroughly?
Yeah, I mean, I'm never been accused of being a conventional mainstream thinker, so that's certainly part of it. Money, the one of the things I like about the Hudson Institute's plan is it doesn't require this massive increase in our shipbuilding budget, because we're just not going to get that. I mean, I think it's a pipe dream. God bless his heart, my friend Brian McGrath. That's his, he's a big advocate of this, and I don't think he's wrong to do it, but I just think it's unrealistic. So let's try to operate in the budgets we're given and continue to ask for more, because that's all we can do. And I do think we need more manpower no matter what we do, because we shrunk the Navy's manpower too far, and we optimally undermanned ships for too long, and our fleet's hurting because of it. And our crews are getting run ragged, and we're doing, for some reason we're doing 200-day deployments and, not deployments, but 200-day underways. And there's some reasons for that, but we don't have enough people, and we arguably don't have enough money. But I think the people side is more important in the thinking side. When we're out of money, it's time to get creative, to kind of paraphrase.
And Chris, we have Lee on the line with a question. Lee, you're live with Chris. Over to you.
Hey, Chris, I wanted to second your comment about lawyers and getting in the way of operating ships, because I've believed for a long time, like you, that there's no particular problem with up-arming CLF ships, with arming MPF ships, with putting military naval persons with weapons on ships. But the argument hits a stone wall when it gets over to the lawyers, and I've known that since 1985, and I don't know how to get around it. I really don't. Maybe somebody is smarter than me and just tell the lawyers to sit down, shut up, and do what needs to be done.
Yeah, Lee. I mean, that's my option. Tell the lawyers, thanks, noted. We'll deal with the legal consequences in court, years from now,
yeah,
in international criminal court.
Yeah.
But we need to win the war.
Well, other navies do it. It's just our particular lawyer's view of the international rules. Isn't that wonderful? And I would be remiss to say that I still think that reestablishing the Naval Armed Guard is one of the solutions to improving the self-defense of non-combatants. You know that.
Yeah, and you and I have talked about that, years,
yeah.
And I think something like that is a good idea. And we have, we have a variation of that with our what's now Maritime Expeditionary Security Squadrons and Embark Security Teams, which are out on our CLF ships, protecting them from various threats. But there's no reason you couldn't take it up a notch and have those guys instead of World War II, they were operating 3-inch guns, right? So what's the equivalent of a 3-inch gun now?
I don't know, a
RAM missile system.
Once again, I think it'd bump into the lawyers. Okay. Just my thought. There's no lawyers on the line. I'll just leave that.
Thanks, Lee.
Okay.
Wait a minute, Eagle.
Well, he's heard all these before. Eagle speaking has already heard me. He's already heard
no
argument.
There may be no JAG lawyers online.
I'll see if my wife will forgive you, Lee, but thanks for taking the question and have a great week.
Okay, out of here.
And we have another question, Chris, from Cal Foster. He's Cal, you are live with Chris. Go ahead.
Hey, Sal. Hi, Chris. Guys, thanks for doing this. This is awesome. I will say, having spent the last year and a half at the Pentagon, the lawyers are always listening. my recall back to active duty here was in support of the Readiness Reform and Oversight Council that we've been implementing all the fixes from McCain and Fitzgerald these last 3 years, and we're kind of coming to the end of the beginning phase. And one of the areas that I'm interested in on the unmanned side is, what kind of technologies are there that potentially we can be employing for, say, Sea Shadow as she makes her deployment and operating in navigable waters and having to abide by the rules of the road and having these automatic systems. I don't have a Tesla, but I know that Teslas have a lot of automatic features in them that allow the driver to avoid, incidences. And I'm kind of wondering, Chris, maybe if you've seen any technologies that are spilling back over into the manned ship fleet from a safety and navigation standpoint.
Hey, buddy, it's good to hear from you. I think you mean Sea Hunter, the medium unmanned surface vessel, and then we've also got these Overlord class ships, which are going to be participating in some fleet experiments here in the next year or so. I don't know if we've seen the back and forth technology or TTPs exchange yet, because I mean that's why we're building these things, is to experiment with them. And I will say, I think we need to build an experiment before we build and procure and build a large number. I think that was the mistake the aviators made with the U-class, which is now the MQ-25 Stingray. They're like, oh, we got to have a program of record instead of just building more prototypes and sort of iterating. So we'll hopefully that works. But for these USVs, I think I'm excited. I'm excited for a number of reasons. One, it's just new technology, and I think USN is at the forefront. From my knowledge, none of our allies or adversaries have any programs like this on the same level of scale. So I think it is going to be, and I know Sal hates this word, I think it's going to be transformational in some respects if we do it right. And there are going to be some lessons learned, and it may not be the panacea to all our BLS shortages or all our naval warfare operating in a dry environment problems. But I think they're important.
Yeah, super. Thanks a lot.
Okay, well, by the hands, if I can read these clocks these days, it has hands on it. We're almost burned out this complete hour with you, Chris, and I want to give you the chance to tell people what you're up to and what they can look forward to from you in the near future and anything else you'd like to throw out at this point. And thank you for being with us, by the way.
Yeah, I think this is my fourth time to be on Midrats. Always a good time, guys, and glad to see you guys continue this, because I think it's an important discussion. You got some great guests. I don't know. I don't have anything to plug. I'm not writing anything, barely reading anything. Just trying to keep my head above surface with my company and the Navy and getting back to some normalcy post this COVID craziness. So I appreciate you guys having me on.
Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure having you. A great hour, as always. I look forward to the next conversation with you. And, hey, hope you have a great Halloween.
All right. You too, guys.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, we hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.